Osho, The Secret of Secrets, Volume 1, Talks on the Secret of the Golden Flower. Discourse Number 3, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India.
Bhagwan, Master Lutsu said, only the primal spirit and the true nature overcome time and space. The primal spirit is beyond the polar differences. Here is the place whence heaven and earth derive their being. When students understand how to grasp the primal spirit, they overcome the polar opposites of light and darkness and tarry no longer in the three worlds. But only he who has envisioned human nature's original face is able to do this. When men are set free from the womb, the primal spirit dwells in the square inch, but the conscious spirit dwells below in the heart. This heart is dependent on the outside world. If a man does not eat for one day even, it feels extremely uncomfortable. If it hears something terrifying, it throbs. If it hears something enraging, it stops. If it is faced with death, it becomes sad. If it sees something beautiful, it is dazzled. But the heavenly heart in the head, when would it have moved in the least? Dost thou ask, can the heavenly heart not move? Then I answer, how could the true thought in the square inch move? The lower heart moves like a strong, powerful commander who despises the heavenly ruler because of his weakness and has usurped the leadership in affairs of state. But when the primal castle can be fortified and defended, then it is as if a strong and wise ruler sat upon the throne. The eyes start the light circulating like two ministers at the right and left who support the ruler with all their might. When rule in the center is thus in order, all those rebellious heroes will present themselves with lances reversed, ready to take orders. The way to the elixir of life knows as supreme magic, seed water, spirit fire, and thought earth, these three. What is seed water? It is the true one energy, Eros. Spirit fire is the light, Logos. Thought earth, intuition.
One day, a king called his clever jester and give him a staff in front of all the court, saying, take this staff as a wand of office and keep it till you find a greater fool than yourself. If you find one, give this wand to him. Sometime later, the king was sick and lay dying. He wanted to see his jester, of whose truthfulness he was sure. When the jester came, the king said to him, I have called you to tell you that I am going on a long journey. Where are you going? Asked the jester. To a far away country, to another world. My master, have you made provision for your journey and your stay there? None whatever, my little fool. Have you any friends to welcome you there? No one, replied the king. Then the jester shook his head sadly and put the staff into the king's hand and said, take this staff, your majesty. This belongs to you, for you are going to another world without preparation. Surely this wand belongs to you and to nobody else. Life is an occasion to prepare for death and the beyond. If you don't prepare for death and for the beyond, you are a fool. You are missing a great opportunity. Life is only an opportunity. This life that you know is not real life. It is only an opportunity to attain to real life. The real life is just hidden somewhere in this life, but it has to be provoked. It has to be awakened. It is fast asleep. It is not yet aware of itself. And if your real life is not aware of itself, your whole so-called life will be nothing but a long dream. And it cannot be sweet either. It will be a nightmare. To live without rooted in the real life is to live like a tree without rooted in the soil. That's why there is no beauty. That's why there is no grace. That's why you don't see the splendor of man. The Buddhas talk about. Jesus goes on saying again and again, the kingdom of God is within you. But you don't seem to be like an emperor. Jesus says to his disciples, look at the lilies in the field. How beautiful they are. Even Solomon, the great king, was not so beautiful, attired in all his grandeur, like these poor flowers of lilies. Why the lilies are so beautiful and men so ugly? Why only man is ugly? Have you ever seen a parrot ugly? Are a peacock ugly? Are a lion ugly? Are a deer ugly? Ugliness seems to be something human. A peacock is a peacock and a deer is a deer. But a man is not necessarily a man. A man is man only when he is a Buddha or a Christ or a Krishna. When he has become aware of his total being. Otherwise, you live groping in the dark. You live in dark caves of the unconscious. You only appear to be conscious. Your consciousness is very fragile. It is very momentary. It is a very thin surface. It is not even skin deep. Just a little scratch and you lose your consciousness. Somebody insults you. Just a word or just a glance and all your consciousness is gone. And you are a rage, anger, violence, aggression. In a moment, the humanity disappears. You are again wild, again an animal. And man can fall below the animals. Because when he falls, there is nothing to stop him. Man can rise above the angels, but it rarely happens. Because to rise above the angels is an uphill task, arduous. One has to work for it. It needs hard work. It needs guts, courage to explore the unknown. Millions of people are born and die, but they never live. Their life is only apparent because they remain rooted in unconsciousness. And whatsoever you do on the surface may not be true about you at all. In fact, exactly opposite is the case. That's why Sigmund Freud has to go into your dreams to see your reality. Just see the irony of it. Your reality has to be surged into your dreams, not in your reality. You cannot be believed what you say about yourself. Your dreams have to be asked. Because you have become so false and you are wearing so many masks that it is almost impossible to penetrate to your original face. But it is very difficult to know your original face even from the dreams and the dream analysis. Who is going to do the analysis? Freud is as much unconscious as you are. One unconscious person is trying to interpret the dreams of another unconscious person. His interpretations are bound to be very limited. His interpretations will reflect more about him than about you. That's why if you go to a Freudian analyst with the same dream, you will get a different interpretation than you will get if you go to a Jungian analyst or to Adlerian analyst. And now there are many. And you will be puzzled. A single dream has different interpretations. They are not saying anything about you. They are saying something about themselves. The Jungian is saying that I am a Jungian. This is my interpretation. Your dreams cannot reveal your truth. If your conscious activities cannot reveal you, how can your sleep activities reveal you? But still, Freud is on the right track. A little more deeper one has to go. One has to go beyond the dreams to a state of mind where no thought, no dream, no desire exists. When all thinking and dreaming is a kind of thinking, primitive kind of thinking, thinking through pictures, but it is still thinking. When you have gone beyond thinking, and if you can remain still alert, aware, as if one is fast asleep, but still alert, deep down, at the very core of one's being, a lamp goes on burning. A small candle of light. Then you will see your original face. And to see your original face is to be back into the Garden of Eden. Then you drop all your clothes. Your personality consists only of clothes and clothes and clothes, clothes upon clothes. Remember two words which will be very important to understand this strange but immensely valuable book, The Secret of the Golden Flower. One word is essence. Another word is personality. Personality comes from a root persona, which means a mask. In ancient days, in Greek dramas, the actors used to wear masks. Persona means a mask. Personality comes from persona. The actors used to wear one mask. You are wearing many, because for different situations you need different masks. When you are talking to your boss, you need one kind of mask. And when you are talking to your servant, of course you need another kind of mask. How can you use the same mask? Have you ever watched? When you are talking to your boss, you are all smiles. Your every breath says, "Yes, sir." Even though you are offended, angry, but you are ready to kiss his feet. And when you are talking to your servant, have you seen the arrogance on your face? You have never smiled. How can you smile talking to your servant? It is impossible. You have to dehumanize him. How can you smile and relate to him as a human being? You have to possess him as a thing. He is a slave. You have to behave in a different way than you behave with your boss. There you are a servant. He remains arrogant. He remains bossy. When you are talking to a friend, you have a different mask to use. When you are talking to any stranger, of course, a different mask is needed. You have to use many masks. And you have many faces, and you go on changing them as circumstances change. Your personality consists only of false faces. And what is essence? Essence is your original face without any mask. Essence is that which you brought in the world when you were born. Essence is that which was with you in the womb. Essence is that which has been given to you by God, or whatsoever you call the totality, the whole existence. Essence is a gift from existence to you. Personality is a gift by the society, parents, school, college, culture, civilization. Personality is not you. It is pseudo. And we continue to polish this personality. And we have completely forgotten the essence. And unless you remember the essence, you would have lived in vain. Because real life consists of essence. A real life is the life of essence. You can call it soul or God within you or whatsoever you will. But remember the distinction.
You are not your clothes, not even your psychological clothes. I must remind you of Moses. When he came face to face to God, when he saw God on the mountains as fires arising out of a green bush, and the bush was not burning, and the bush was as fresh, as green as ever, he was puzzled. He could not believe his eyes. It was impossible. Such fire, the bush was aflame, and yet the bush was not burning. And then he heard from the bush a voice coming to him, "Moses, put off your shoes, because you are on the holy ground." This is one of the most beautiful Jewish parables. God is the fire. Your personality is just the bush. And God is a cool fire. It will not burn your personality. The personality can remain green. God gives you so much freedom that if you want to be false, it is allowed. It is okay with him. If you want to be pseudo, it is allowed. Freedom means that you can be right or you can be wrong. This is up to you. Your essence is there, the flame is there. And your personality is also there. The personality is false. And naturally one will think, why not the fire within you burns it? The fire is cool. The fire cannot burn it. If you have decided to have this personality, the fire allows it. You can remain green in your personality. The personality can go on gathering more and more foliage. You can become more and more false. You can become utterly false. You can be lost in the falsehood of the personality. And God is not going to interfere. Remember this, God never interferes. Freedom is total. That is the dignity of man, the glory of man, and the agony too. If you were not given freedom, you would not have been false. No other animal is false. No other animal has personality. And I am not counting the pet animals, because with you they live. They are destroyed. They start having personalities. Your dogs forget their essence. The dog may be angry, but goes on wagging his tail. This is personality. He knows who is the boss. And he knows how to buttress the ego of the boss. He has become diplomatic. He is as much a politician as the people who live in New Delhi. He goes on wagging his tail. Have you seen the dog? Sometimes puzzled, a stranger comes in and the dog does not know how to behave, what face to show to the stranger. Ambiguous. He barks. Maybe that is the right thing to do. And still he goes on wagging the tail. He is watching for right hints from the boss. Whether the person who has entered the house is a friend or a foe. If he is a foe, he will stop wagging the tail. If he is a friend, he will stop barking at him. He is waiting for a hint, a signal. How the master behaves. He has become a shadow of the master. He is no more a real dog. To live with human beings is contagious. They destroy. Even you destroy animals if they live with you. You don't allow them their natural essence. You civilize them just as you have become civilized. You don't allow nature to have its own way. You don't allow Tao to have its own flow. Essence is that which you bring in the world. The personality is that the world imposes upon the essence. The world is very much afraid of the essence, because the essence is always rebellious. The essence is always individualistic. And the world does not need any individuals. It needs sheep. It does not need rebellious people. It does not need people like Buddhas, Krishnas, Lao Tzus. No. These people are dangerous. It wants people who are obedient. Obedient to the status quo. Obedient to the vested interests. Obedient to the organized church. Obedient to the state and the stupid politicians. But society requires obedience. And society requires efficiency. The more mechanical you are, the more efficient you are, the more alive you are, you cannot be that much efficient. A machine is more efficient than man. The society's effort is to reduce every man into a machine. And how to reduce a man into a machine? Make him more and more unconscious. Make him more and more robot-like. Let his essence completely disappear from his consciousness. Let him become perfectly pseudo. Let him be a husband. Let her be a wife, a servant, a boss, this and that. But never let him be his essential self. Don't allow that. Because that essential self is not obedient to anybody except to God. It has no other commitment. Its sole commitment is to the source. It knows no other masters. That type of being will be very inconvenient to this so-called society. Because this society is not created to fulfill the needs of human beings. It is created to exploit human beings. It is not according to you and for your growth. It has no intention to help you to grow. And it has all intentions not to allow you to grow. Because the more you grow, the more you become independent. The less you grow, the more you remain dependent. And a dependent person is reliable. Because a dependent person is always afraid. A dependent person always needs somebody to lean to. Always needs somebody to lean to. He is childish. He leans on the parents. He leans on the priests. He leans on the politicians. He cannot stand on his own feet. The society goes on covering you with many, many clothes. Not only physical, psychological too. The society is very much afraid of physical nakedness, because the physical nakedness is the beginning of psychological nakedness. The society goes in panic seeing a naked man, because this is the beginning. If he is naked physically, he has taken the first step. Now who is going to prevent him from becoming psychologically naked? And the voice that called forth from the burning bush to Moses said, put off your shoes. It is a very symbolic thing. Put off all your clothes, it says. Put off all your shoes. Shoes cover your feet. Shoes cover you. Be naked on the ground. Be without shoes. The shoe represents personality, and nakedness represents essence. You are on the holy ground. Put off your shoes. The moment you encounter your essence, the burning bush within you, you will have to put off all your shoes. You will have to put off all your clothes. You will have to put off all that is hiding your essence. That is revolution, metanoia. That is the turning point in a life. The society disappears and you become an individual. And only individuals can relate with God. But a great consciousness will be needed. Gurdjieff once, in 1933, treated Peters to a demonstration of this at the former's New York apartment in the Henry Hudson Hotel, where Peters was convoked. Peters was a young disciple of Gurdjieff. And Gurdjieff was one of the greatest masters the world has ever known. And not a conventional master at all, because no master can be conventional. Conventional is the quality of the priest, not of the master. The master is always revolutionary. And this is a beautiful experiment. Listen attentively. When he arrived, he was asked to wash dishes and prepare vegetables for some very important people who were coming to dinner. Gurdjieff said he needed Peters to give him an English lesson consisting of words for all those parts and functions of the body that were not in the dictionary. By the time Gurdjieff had mastered the four-letter words and obscene phrases, the guests started arriving, who turned out to be some 15 well-dressed, well-mannered New Yorkers, of which a number were reporters or journalists. After staging a late and obsequious entry, the host humbly began responding at table to the guests' blasé questions on his work and reasons for visiting America. When with a wink to his English teacher, he suddenly changed tone and explained that the sad degeneration of humankind and its transformation into a substance only describable by a four-letter expletive, was particularly striking in their country, whence his coming to observe this phenomenon in the Ra. The cause behind this distressing state of affairs, he continued, lay in the fact that people, especially Americans, never followed the dictates of intelligence or propriety, but only that of their genital organs. Then signaling out one particularly handsome woman, he complimented her on her attire and makeup, after which he confided that in all honesty between them, the real explanation behind her adornment was an irresistible sexual urge she felt for some particular person, graphically spelled out by Gurdjieff with his newly acquired vocabulary. Before the guests could react, he launched into a discourse on his own sexual prowess, followed by intimate and detailed descriptions of the sexual mores of various races and nations. By the time dinner was over, and the guests well plied with the good old Armagnac as always, they lost their inhibitions and joined in an exchange of obscenities, which soon became more than verbal. Gurdjieff retired with the lady whom he had insulted, and the others, by now conditioned to believe that an orgy or something was in tenor of the evening, began entangling physically in different rooms of the apartment in various stages of undress. Just when the carousal was at a climax, Gurdjieff briskly disengaged himself and thundered forth orders for the revels to cease, proclaiming that the lesson had been accomplished, that the guests had already amply verified through their comportment the soundness of his observations made earlier in the evening, that thanks to him they were now partly conscious of their true condition, and that he would gladly accept from them checks and cash in payment for this important lesson. Peters noted without surprise, knowing Gurdjieff, that the take came to several $1,000. When everyone had left, Gurdjieff went into the kitchen to help Peters with the dishes, asking at the same time how he had enjoyed the evening. "I was disgusted," came the reply. Gurdjieff laughed and scrutinized his companion with a piercing look. "Is fine feeling you have, this disgust. But now is necessary ask yourself one question, with who you disgusted." This is the real situation. What you sow on the surface is one thing. Those guests were annoyed, angered by the observation of George Gurdjieff that humanity has become very degraded. That what you do on the surface is one thing, what you mean deep inside is another. You may give explanations and you may rationalize, but your rationalizations are just rationalizations and nothing else. Deep down, something else goes on working in the unconscious. You are not even aware of it. Psychologists say that when a woman is raped, in majority of cases, the woman wanted to be raped. She had the desire. She was inviting. She was using certain gestures, the way she will walk, the way she will dress, the way she will talk, were all gestures inviting to be raped. And then one day it happens, and then she looks surprised, angry, violent, goes to the police, fights in the court. And if she had looked deep down in her own mind, she would be more surprised that it was her own effort, her own desire has been fulfilled. There are people who go on living in this double way, not even aware what are their real motives inside. You watch, and that watching will make you very, very alert. Just watch. What is your real motive? Don't try to convince yourself that this is not so. Just become a mirror and see your behavior. Just become a silent watcher of your behavior. Alert always why you are doing a certain thing, from where it is coming. And then you will see you have a dual being. One is the personality, which says one thing. And another is your reality, which goes on doing just the other. And somehow they both have to manage with each other. Hence the conflict, the friction, and the wastage of energy. And it happens almost in all cases that you have one desire inside and just the opposite on the outside. And why the opposite? Because through the opposite you are repressing that desire. The person who feels inferior deep inside pretends to be very superior on the outside. Only inferior people want to be superior. Those who are really superior don't care a bit. All people who suffer from inferiority complexes become politicians, because that is the only way to prove that they are very superior. The person who has the look on his face of holier than thou knows that deep inside just the opposite is the case. He is suffering from guilt. He is suffering deep down from unworthiness. He knows that he is unholy. Now the only way to hide it from the world is to have a mask of holiness. Your so-called sins are not a bit different from the sinners. The only difference is sinners are honest and your sins are not honest. Out of 100 sins, if you can find even one saint who is really a saint, that will be more than enough. More than one can expect. 99 are just pretending. And I am not saying that they are pretending only to you. The pretensions can go so deep that they are not only deceiving others, they start deceiving themselves. In fact, to deceive oneself, first you have to deceive others. Only then you can believe in it. When others start believing that you are a saint, then only you can believe in it. The real saint is not concerned with others at all. He knows who he is. Even if the whole world says that he is not a saint, that doesn't matter. His understanding is inner. His encounter is direct with himself. His experience is immediate and existential. He knows his essence. And to know one's essence is the first step in knowing God, in becoming immortal, in going beyond death. Henry Bergson spoke of the beginning, at the beginning of this century, he said, the addition to the body brought by technology calls for a corresponding addition to the soul. The modern man looks more soulless than any other age. And the reason is, science and technology have added much to the body. The body has become more stronger, lives longer. The brain has become more stronger, has become more knowledgeable. Compared to the body and the brain is part of the body, the soul has remained very, very poor. It is almost neglected, ignored. Nobody cares about it. Who thinks about one's own essence? Going to the church or to the temple is not going to help. You will have to go within yourself. You will have to put off your shoes. You will have to go into your naked essence. Only then you will be able to reconnect yourself with the cosmos. It is from there you can be bridged again with reality. Now the sutras. Master Lutasu said, only the primal spirit and the true nature overcome time and space. What I have been telling you about essence, Master Lutasu says, is the primal spirit. The primal spirit is your essential soul, that which you have brought from God, untaught, unconditioned. As you were in your mother's womb, how you existed in your mother's womb, nothing was taught to you. You had no mind. You existed in a state of no mind. Hence, the blissfulness of it. Psychologists say that because of the experience of mother's womb, those 9 months, man has been searching for God. Because of those 9 months' experience, the memory haunts him. Those 9 months were the most beautiful that you have known. Maybe you have forgotten consciously, but deep down, in the very cells of your body, in the very fibers of your being, those days still are pulsating. Those days are still carried by your existence. You may not be conscious in your mind, but they are there. Just like when in the night you fall in deep sleep, you don't know where you go and what happens to you, but in the morning you feel the relaxation, the freshness, the joy. Life has again happened to you. All the dust that you had gathered has disappeared. You are again fresh. You are rejuvenated. Your body carries the feeling. Your body is calm and quiet and remembers something. The remembrance is not in the brain. You don't know what happened exactly, where you had gone. Only a Buddha knows where he goes in his deep sleep, because even in his deep sleep he remains alert. You are not alert even when you are aware, the so-called awareness. You are not alert when you are in that so-called wakeful state. Your eyes are open, but your mind goes on weaving and spinning 1001 thoughts. The inner talk continues. The inner noise continues. You see and yet you don't see, and you hear yet you don't hear, because deep inside there is a wall of thoughts, dreams, continuously floating in the sky of your consciousness. You are not alert even when you are awake. The Buddha is alert even when he is fast asleep. Only he knows where he goes. Where he goes? He goes to the essence, to the source, to the primal spirit. And even if few moments in every night you fall into the primal source, you are rejuvenated. The man who cannot fall into deep sleep is really in hell. He goes tired to the bed, exhausted, bored with life, and gets in the morning even more tired, more bored, more exhausted. His life is hell. In deep sleep, you simply slip back into the primal source of your being. That primal source is always there. You have not lost it. You have only forgotten it. And that primal source is beyond all dualities. It is neither light nor darkness. It is transcendental. It is neither life nor death as you know. It is transcendental. It is neither man nor woman as you know. It is transcendental. It is beyond all kinds of dualities. It is God. Only the primal spirit and the true nature overcome time and space. When you are in the primal spirit, you are in your true nature. When you are in your personality, you are untrue. You are just a plastic phenomenon. Watch, and you will be surprised how many things are plastic in you. You smile when there is no smile in the heart, then it is plastic. You sympathize when there is no sympathy in you, it is plastic. You sow joy when there is no joy in you, it is plastic. You can even cry and weep. Without your heart feeling anything, then those tears are plastic. Just watch how many things are plastic in you. And remember, whatsoever is plastic is not you. God has not made you a plastic thing. God has given you eternal life. But that eternal life you can find only when you put off your shoes. Put off your personality. Drop all personas, all masks. Let all masks disappear. It will be painful. Because you have become identified with those masks. You think they are your faces. It is going to be almost a very painful process of death. And not only once, you will have to die many times. Because each time a face falls, you will find a death has happened. But again, new life will be released in you. Fresher, deeper, more vibrant. When all the faces disappear and the essence is left alone, you have transcended all duality. Even the duality of time and space. When you enter in deep meditation, when you enter in your essential being, there is no space and no time. You cannot say where you are. All wheres disappear. You cannot pinpoint the place. Either you are nowhere or you are everywhere. Only these are the two possibilities. Both mean the same. Few people have chosen to say one is everywhere. Vedanta has chosen to say that in deep meditation one is everywhere. Aham Brahmasmi. I am God. God means one who is everywhere, who permeates the whole existence. You become space itself. And I am always, I am eternal. It means you permeate the time. This is one way of expressing it, the positive way. Buddhism has chosen the other, the negative way. Buddha says, in deep meditation you are nowhere. All space has disappeared. And there is no time. You are in a timeless state. And when there is no time and no space, how can you exist? Man exists only at the crossing point of time and space. One line of time, another line of space cross. And at that crossing, the ego arises. Take away these two lines, and the point of the ego disappears. It was only a crossing of two lines. It was a fallacious idea. So Buddha says there is nobody. In deep meditation, time disappears, space disappears, and you disappear. All disappears. There is only nothingness. Sunya. Zero. This is the negative way of saying the same thing. Either you can say, I am God, if you choose the positive expression, which has its own dangers, its own beauties too. Or you can choose the negative expression, anatta, no self, nothingness, nirvana. It has its beauties and its dangers too. The very idea of nothingness puts people off. That is the danger. Who wants to be nothing? Again and again Buddha is asked in his 40 years ministry that why one should try to be nothing? That will be a death, ultimate death. And Buddha says, yes, it is the ultimate death, but it is beautiful. And the questioners ask, but to whom it is beautiful? Because there is nobody. And Buddha says, there is only beauty. Beatitude. Nobody to experience it. Naturally, the human mind says, but then what is the point? If I am not there, and it is very beautiful, so let it be beautiful, but I am not there. So whether it is beautiful or not makes no difference to me. Why I should lose myself? It is better to be in a world which is not so beautiful, but at least I am. The goal of nothingness puts people off. That's why from India Buddhism disappears. And it learned a lesson. In China, it dropped the negative language. In Tibet, it dropped the negative language. The Indian Buddhism, the original Buddhism, was absolutely negative. Under the influence of Buddha, thousands were transformed. But you cannot find the man like Buddha every day. The impact of Buddha was such that people were even ready to die and become nothing. That was because of Buddha. Otherwise, there is no enchantment, no charm in being nothing. But Buddha's magnetism was such. His charisma was such that thousands of people were ready to become nothing. If Buddha says it, it must be right. His word was so important. His eyes were a witness to it. He has disappeared. So let us also disappear. And if he says, then we can trust. But once Buddha disappeared from the earth, Buddhist priests could not convince people. They had to disappear from India completely. Then they learned a lesson. Outside India, Buddhism started using positive language. It started using all that Buddha has denied. It survived, but it survived not really as the Buddhism. It survived as Vedanta. It survived as a positive language. And Buddha's greatest contribution was the negative expression. The beauty of the negative expression is that it never allows your ego any satisfaction, any gratification. That is the danger of the positive language. If you say, Aham Brahmasmi, I am God, Anal Haq, I am truth, the danger is, truth may become secondary and the I may become primary. Truth may become your shadow. The emphasis may start concentrating on the word I. I am God. If the emphasis remains on God and the I remains just a shadow to God, it is perfectly good. But that is very difficult. The I is very cunning. The ego's ways are very subtle. It will use the opportunity. It will jump upon the idea. It will say, right, I am God and nobody else is. I am truth and everybody else is a lie. But then the whole point is missed. But one thing is certain, time and space disappears. Either you have to declare, I am all, the whole space, the whole time, I am everywhere and every when, or you have to use Buddhist expression, I am not, time is not, space is not. There is only an absolute silent nothing. From eternity to eternity, a silence. Not even a ripple. But both states indicate to the same. Expressions are different. Fingers are different but pointing to the same moon. That moon is your essence. Master Luthus said, only the primal spirit and the true nature overcome time and space. And unless you overcome time and space, you will not overcome death. Death exists in time. And death exists in space. Unless you overcome time and space, you will not overcome mind and body. Try to understand. Body corresponds to space, and mind corresponds to time. Mind is a time phenomenon, and body is a space phenomenon. Body exists somewhere, and mind exists somewhere. Think of mind without time, and you will not be able to think. Mind is either past, present, or future. Either memory, our imagination, or the present facticity. Mind exists in three tenses. You are listening to me attentively, alert. Mind is in the present. If you are thinking here of other things, you have read in the Bible something and it corresponds with me or does not correspond with me and you have gone into your imagination or into your memory. You cannot think of mind if time disappears. Time is synonymous with mind. Man is a miniature cosmos. A miniature universe. All that exists outside on a greater scale exists on a small scale in man. If you can understand man, you would have understood the whole universe. As above, so below. Man is the atomic constituent of this whole universe. If one atom is understood, you have understood all matters. If one man is understood, if you can decipher your own mystery, you have deciphered all the mysteries possible. Past, present, future, all. And these two things have to be remembered. Body is space. Mind is time. When you meditate, you disappear from the body. You don't know who you are. Man, woman, ugly, beautiful, black, white. Simply you don't know who you are. When you go in, the body is left far behind. A moment comes when you cannot even locate where your body is, and you cannot feel its presence even. You are no more attached to the form. You have become formless. And the same happens with the mind. You don't know where your mind is, where that mind has gone. All that noise, that traffic noise that was constantly inside becomes distant, 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 and disappears. Suddenly, a great silence explodes in you. In this state of no space and no time, you come to know your essence. And to know one's essence is to have the first glimpse of Tao. The primal spirit is beyond the polar differences. All the polar differences disappear. Man, woman, summer, winter, heart, cold, love, hate, positive, negative, time, space, life, death, all polar opposites disappear. The primal spirit is beyond the polar differences. And that's why I insist again and again that don't get attached to any polarity. You have been taught to become attached to some polarity. Your so-called religions have been teaching you, either be worldly, or renounce and go to the monasteries. I shall remain in the world and don't be of it. Otherwise you will become attached to a polarity. If you go to the monastery, you will be afraid of the marketplace. What kind of attainment is this? If there is fear, there is no attainment. And I know people who have lived in the Himalayas, then they become afraid. Then they don't want to come to the world. Because whatsoever they have been experiencing in the Himalayas, when they come to the marketplace, disappears. If it disappears in the marketplace, it is no attainment. It may have been just the silence of the Himalayas that you mistook as your silence. It was borrowed. Certainly the Himalaya is silent. And if you live in that silence, slowly, slowly, that silence starts permeating you. But it is not your music. It is borrowed. Go away from the Himalayas and it will disappear. This is creating a fallacy. This is enjoying a reflected glory. This is not your own glory. Live in the marketplace and create a Himalaya in the heart. Become silent in the noise. Remain a householder and yet be a sannyasin. That's why I emphasize it so much, that I don't want my sannyasins to renounce. Nothing has to be renounced. The way of renunciation is the way of the escapist. And the way of renunciation will make you attached to a polar phenomenon. That will not give you freedom. Freedom is in transcendence. And transcendence comes only when you live in the polar opposites simultaneously, together. So be in the world, but don't let the world be in you. Love and yet don't be lost in it. Relate and yet be alone, utterly alone. Know perfectly well that all relationship is a game. Play the game and play it as beautifully as possible and as skillfully as possible. A game is after all a game and has to be played beautifully. And follow all the rules of the game, because a game cannot exist without rules. But remember always that it is just a game. Don't become attached to it. Don't become serious in it. Always allow the sense of humor to remain alive in you. Remain sincere but non-serious. And then, slowly, slowly you will see polarities are disappearing. Who is worldly and who is otherworldly? You are both or neither. The primal spirit is beyond the polar differences. Here is the place whence heaven and earth derive their being. When students understand how to grasp the primal spirit, they overcome the polar opposites of light and darkness and tarry no longer in the three worlds, the world of heaven, the world of earth and the world of hell, the three worlds. They all disappear for the person who knows how to transcend polarities. I told you just few moments before that past, present, future, these are the three worlds. Past is hell, because it is dead. It is ghostly. Ghosts following you. Present is the earth, the facticity, the fact, that which is right now and here. And future is heaven. Hopes, aspirations, desires, longings. These are the three worlds. And you will have to move in these three worlds constantly. You will be settled back and forth. From the past you jump to the future, from the future you jump to the past, and this goes on. And present is so minute that you are not very aware of it. It is sandwiched between the past and the future, and they are vast, and the present is a very minute atomic moment, so small that you don't even see it. The moment you become aware of it, it is already past. To be present to the present, one needs to be very attentive, utterly attentive. And that's why to be present to the present becomes the door to go beyond time. You cannot go from the past, because past is so vast, infinite. You can go on and on. You will not find the end of it. That's why I say psychoanalysis will not help. It goes in the past. And it goes on unraveling the past, digging the past. You can go on. Psychoanalysis continues for years, 3 years, 7 years. Then too it is not complete. One simply becomes bored with the psychoanalyst and then changes the psychoanalyst and goes to somebody else and it starts from ABC again. And one thing I would like to say to you, sooner or later, psychoanalysis is bound to discover that this life is not the end of the past. You can go moving backwards and you can come to what Geno calls the primal screen. Primal screen is the ultimate of psychoanalysis. The first scream of the child when he started breathing. Through it he started breathing. The first scream. But once you have reached there, you will be surprised. That is not the beginning either. Then you have to move into the womb. In the East we have tried. We had a very, very deep going method called pratiprasava. Going back, going back. Mahavira used it, Buddha used it. They went through the womb, and then again you have to go through death, because before the womb you died. And then the whole life again. Layer upon layer. It is through deep psychoanalysis that the East became aware of the phenomena of many lives. Christianity, Judaism, Islam are not aware of it. They never tried so hard. They have never tried psychoanalysis. Freud is the first Jew to have tried it. And of course, Christians and Jews and all the so-called religious people were against him. The fear is that if psychoanalysis goes deeper, sooner or later, the Hindu idea of rebirth will be proved right. That is the fear. If you go on digging, you will find layer upon layer. Where you will end? Thousands of lives you have lived as men, and we have tried to penetrate all those, but then too there is no end. One day suddenly you see that before this life you were not a man, you were an elephant or a tiger or a dog, and then you start moving in animal lives, and before that, after millions of lives, you will suddenly one day discover that you were a bush or a tree, and then a rock. In India we say millions of lives you have passed. Where it can lead? The analysis of the past cannot lead anywhere. It can drive you crazy, but it leads nowhere. And so is the case with the future. Where to stop? How far is far enough? Where to make a point that now we will not look ahead? In the East we have tried that too, because we have worked tremendously on the concept of time. And both are unending. Memory is unending, imagination is unending. Between the two is the present moment, very tiny, so tiny that you cannot become aware of it if you are not absolutely alert. It goes so fast, it is so fleeting. But if you become aware of the present, then a door opens. The door to eternity. That is from there mind moves into no mind. That is from there personality moves beyond personality into essence. You know perfectly well, Jesus was hanged. He had two thieves who were hanged with him. One was on his left side, another was on his right side. You may not have ever thought it as a tremendously significant symbol. Jesus represents the present moment. One thief is the past, another thief is the present, and another thief is the future. And Jesus represents the present moment. Closest to God, closest to essence. One thief mocked Jesus. The past always mocks you. Condemned Jesus. The past always condemns you. Another thief asks Jesus about the future. What will happen after death? Will I be able to see you in heaven? One is past, another is future. And Jesus is just sandwiched between these two thieves. And why I call them thieves? Past is a thief, future is a thief, because they go on stealing your present. They are thieves. To me, this is a parable. I don't know whether any Christian will agree with me or not, but that is not my business at all. I don't care whether anybody agrees with me or not. Jesus is present here now, closest to the essence, just ready to die and disappear into the body and the mind. Hesitates a little bit, everybody hesitates. When you will come to the present and you will see eternity facing you. No past, no future, but eternity. A totally different dimension. Past, present, future are horizontal. Eternity is vertical. Again, to me the cross is the symbol of these two lines crossing. A cross is made by two lines, one horizontal, another vertical. This is a representation of time and eternity. Everybody hesitates when one faces eternity. Nowhereness, nothingness, or allness. It is so much. One is going to disappear into it like a drop. And the ocean is so big, one will not be found again. Even a dewdrop falling into the ocean from a grass leaf hesitates. Jesus hesitated, and I love this man because he hesitated. His hesitation shows that he was human. His hesitation shows that he belonged to us. He was Son of Man. He cried to God, "Have you forsaken me? What are you doing to me? Have you abandoned me? Are you no more with me? I am disappearing and I don't see your hands protecting me." The dewdrop is falling in the ocean. Where are you? I am falling into a deep nothingness. Death has arrived, and I had always hoped that in death you will be there waiting, and you will embarrass me. You will take me in your fold. You will be warm and loving. But where are you? Have you forsaken me? Have you abandoned me? I don't see you anywhere. In fact, there is no God to be seen. God is not a person. God is a positive name of this absolute nothingness. But Jesus has lived with the Jewish idea of God as a person. Hence this turmoil in his mind, fear in his mind. He can't see. He was waiting to see the Beloved, the Father. He used to call the Father Abba. He was waiting to find his Father. But there seems to be nobody. The world is finished, and beyond is nothing but an yawning nothingness, an abyss with no bottom. It is very human. The life of Jesus is very human, and that is the beauty of it. That's why it has impressed so many people. His very humanity is touching. But then he saw the point. He must have looked deep into the eternity, the nothingness. He must have seen the point that God cannot have a human face. This is his face, that God cannot have human hands. That this nothingness is ready to embarrass me, to take me deep into its heart. And then he said to God, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done." So be it so. Let it be so. So you are nothingness, I am ready, I trust you. I will trust even your nothingness. Every Christian, every Mohammedan, every Hindu, every Jew, whosoever has lived with the idea of God's personality will have to face this. Will have to go through this anxiety period, this anguish. That is the beauty of the Buddha's idea and the Taoist idea that God is nothingness. Another name for nothingness. One who has lived with that idea of nothingness from the very beginning will not hesitate, will simply disappear into it. When students understand how to grasp the primal spirit is beyond the polar differences, here is the place where heaven and earth derive their being. When students understand how to grasp the primal spirit, they overcome the polar opposites of light and darkness and tarry no longer in the three worlds. But only he who has envisioned human nature's original face is able to do it. Unless you have been able to see your own inner nothingness, you will not be able to do it. First meditate and go into your inner nothingness. Then you will be able to enter into the nothingness of existence itself. When men are set free from the womb, the primal spirit dwells in the square inch. This is a Taoist map. Don't get puzzled. There are different maps about human consciousness. Different maps use different symbols. This is a Taoist map. Taoists say that after a child is born from the womb, the primal spirit starts dwelling on the third eye, between the two eyes, between the two exists the third, exactly in the middle. What yoga map says, Ajna Chakra, the third eye center. That's what Taoists say, the dwelling place of the primal spirit. The primal spirit dwells in the square inch, but the conscious spirit dwells below in the heart. But the conscious spirit dwells in the heart, the ordinary physical heart. This heart is dependent on the outside world. If a man does not eat for one day, even, it feels extremely uncomfortable. If it hears something terrifying, it throbs. If it hears something enraging, it stops. If it is faced with death, it becomes sad. If it sees something beautiful, it is dazzled. But the heavenly heart in the head, that is in the third eye center, when would it have moved in the least? Dost thou ask, can the heavenly heart not move? Then I answer, how could the true thought in the square inch move? This physical heart is constantly dependent on the outside world. It is affected by the outside world. It is part of the outside world inside you. This is not the true heart. Taoists say the true heart is in the third eye. It moves not. It is unmoving. It is always the same. The physical heart is always in a chaos. And the spiritual heart in the third eye is always in order. It is order itself. That's why Hindus have called it Ajna Chakra, the center from where orders arise, discipline arises. If something comes from the third eye, it is immediately followed. The whole body follows it. The whole being follows it. It is the center from where commandments are issued, but it is fast asleep. You live from the physical heart. You have not known your spiritual heart yet. The lower heart moves like a strong, powerful commander who despises the heavenly ruler because of his weakness. But the physical heart thinks the spiritual heart is weak because it moves not. And because it moves not, you remain unaware of it. You become aware of only things when they move. If something remains absolutely unmoving, you become oblivious of it. And the lower heart thinks itself very strong and thinks about the heavenly heart, the spiritual heart, as weak, almost dead, because it moves not. And has usurped the leadership in affairs of his state. And because of this, the lower heart has become the master of you. But when the primal castle can be fortified and defended, then it is as if a strong and wise ruler sat upon the throne. But if you start becoming more and more alert and more conscious, you will find that you have fortified the primal castle in the third eye. Whenever you become aware, you will be surprised. You start functioning from the third eye. Just become a little bit aware and you will see a little strain on the third eye. Whenever you become alert, the strain is more on the third eye. Something starts throbbing in the third eye. Something starts pulsating in the third eye. Once awareness has made the third eye function, once awareness has moved in the third eye, and the third eye starts functioning becomes alive. That's why Hindus call it a chakra. Chakra means a wheel. The wheel needs energy. Once the energy comes in, the wheel starts moving. By movement is meant it starts functioning. Then a great revolution happens in your being. Immediately the lower heart bows down to the higher heart. When the higher comes, the lower always bows down. It rules only when the higher is not present. And that is the difference between a real religion and an unreal religion. The unreal religion says to you, try to control yourself. Do this, don't do that. Control your senses. Discipline your body. The real religion says, just go into the third eye center and let the spiritual heart function, and all will be controlled and all will be disciplined. Let the master arrive and everything will be settled immediately. The eyes start the light circulating like the ministers at the right and left who support the ruler with all their might. When rule in the center is thus in order, all those rebellious heroes will present themselves with lenses reverse ready to take orders. Just let the master come in. And there is no need to make any effort to create an order in your life. There is no need to cultivate character. That's why I say don't be worried about character. You simply put all your energy in being more conscious. Consciousness is followed by a character as you are followed by your shadow. If you try to cultivate a character, your character will be false pseudo and you will become a hypocrite. And this is not the way to reach to the ultimate. The way to the elixir of life knows as supreme magic. This is the supreme magic. Why I call it magic? Because once the higher heart has started functioning, as if a magical miracle happens. Your senses were never in order. Your mind was always confused. You were always hesitating to do this or to do that, to be or not to be. You were in constant tension, where to go, what to choose. Suddenly, as if somebody has done a miracle, all confusion disappears, clarity arises, life becomes transparent. You simply do that which has to be done. In fact, once the heavenly heart has started functioning, all that you do is good. You cannot do wrong. It is impossible. The way to the elixir of life knows as supreme magic. And three are the constituents of this supreme magic: seed water, spirit fire, and thought earth. These are Taoist symbols. These three. What is seed water? It is the true one energy, Eros. Spirit fire is the light, Logos. Thought earth is intuition. You will have to understand these three. Seed water is Eros, the energy that you know now as sexual energy. The energy of passion. Right now, it creates only troubles for you and nothing else. Right now, it pretends to be your friend, but proves to be your foe. The more you follow it, the more it takes you into miseries. That's why it is said, love is blind. Mulla Nasruddin was saying to me, love is blind and marriage is an eye opener. Love is blind because you don't have eyes yet, and a great energy that could have become a great blessing to you becomes only misery. Eros is your energy, and Freud is right. To seek and search everything into your eros, into your sexual energy. But he is wrong, because he does not know that this ordinary state of sexual energy is not its natural state. It is a perverted state. In its natural state, sexual energy rises higher and higher. It takes you upwards, not downwards. In its natural state, sexual energy becomes the golden flower within you. In ordinary, the so-called perverted state, it simply takes you into new prisons, because it moves outward and downwards. It dissipates you. It only brings your death closer and closer. If the same energy starts moving upwards, it brings a new life, life in abundance. It becomes elixir of life. Just as the mud can become lotus, the mud contains the lotus, the seed of it, so your sexual energy contains the seed of the golden flower. But the energy has to move upwards. You cannot move it upwards. There are people who try to make it move upwards. They become sexual perverts and nothing else. You cannot do it directly, but you can do it indirectly. Once your third eye starts functioning, your spiritual heart, energy starts moving on its own accord. You have created the third eye, and the energy is attracted as if towards a magnet. Right now your energy moves outwards because you have magnets outside, far greater than you have inside. You see a beautiful woman, and the energy starts moving outwards. The woman functions like a magnet. When your third eye functions, you have such a strong magnet that nobody can pull you outwards. It is just a question of having a bigger magnet than exists outside. Then the energy moves upwards, inwards. If you go outwards, you will move into the world of duality. If you go inwards, you will move into the world of non-duality. You will become non-polar. This is exactly the foundation of what I call metapsychology, or the psychology of the Buddhas. This is pure religion, not the religion of the rituals, but pure religion. Nothing to do with Christianity and Hinduism, but something to do with your energy source. The second is spirit fire. It is light, logos. It is conscious mind. Eros, moving upwards, takes you beyond conscious and unconscious mind. Logos is conscious mind. It is psychology. It is science. Thought earth is darkness, unconsciousness, intuition. It is parapsychology, art. Thought earth is intuition, darkness. Women live in the thought earth, in the intuitive vision. Women live as unconscious, illogical. Men live in the spirit fire, logos, logic, conscious mind. Artists are feminine. Scientists are masculine. And the seed water, the eros, the one energy, is non-dual. It takes you beyond art and beyond science. It takes you beyond unconscious and beyond conscious. It takes you beyond man and beyond woman. It takes you into the non-dual, the transcendental. But the secret of the magic is to let your heavenly heart function, which exists between your two eyes. Later on, we will go into the methodology of it, how to help it function. Enough for today.